On the Empire podcast this week, we have more guests than Christmas round Jamie Lee Curtis's house because of
Christopher
Guest.
And also she's a fabulous hostess.
Fabulous hostess. Lots of great turkey. Lots of turkeys in Jamie Lee Curtis's house. Not her career.
Thank you.
We need to make it absolutely clear. This is still the intro. First up, we have Chloe Grace Moretz talking about the miseducation of Cameron Post. Then we have Dev Bautista talking about shooting at West Ham's ground, something West Ham fans won't know anything about. Boom, that's a football joke. And last but not least, we have Bart Layton and Barry Keoghan talking about American Animals. Woof! All that and more on the movie podcast that might, just might, be playing Thomas Wayne. We shall see. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Jam-packed bumper round this week, and we're going to be racing through it. And I'll be racing through it with two colleagues of such lethal cunning. We have our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well, except for I joined a new gym, and now none of my limbs work.
Why did you do this? You already run three marathons a week.
I don't know. I was trying to get better at running marathons, and I thought if I did some cross training, that would be helpful. And now I literally can't lift my arms and everything hurts.
Oh my God.
I might be dying.
James Dyer is also here, which is nice, I guess.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm feeling bathed in the warm embrace of your welcome.
What's your keep fit regime?
I
crushes his enemies.
Yes. I crush my enemies, see them driven before me and hear the lamentation of the women. That's pretty much it. And push a giant wooden wheel around while sort of grunting and sweating.
And are you carb loading during this? Well, what's your
Atkins
protein
actually.
Shake?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, Eileen Atkins. Well, what is that?
No, my get fit regimen is relegated to occasionally not taking the lift at work. Because my impatience outweighs my laziness.
I got back into it in a big way this week.
Lift or?
No, fitness.
Really?
The whole running thing. I got back in a big way because as of this week, in fact, as of last week, but now officially as of this week, I will be coming in your ears every single morning, desired.
Because
Empire is hitting Alexa. Jimbo, you can explain this as well because I do it, but I still don't understand what it is.
Yeah, so your voice comes out of the magic box because the genie in it sort of channels you.
Yes,
and
thank
that's
you.
How it works. Yeah.
So there's a genie that lives inside your Alexa.
It's a special lamp that you can buy from Amazon. It's called an Alexa lamp, and then they rub it, and then they ask the genie for the movie news, and your voice comes in and gives them the news. So yes,
to be clear, you don't have to rub your Alexa to make it work.
Well, then I'm doing it wrong.
Well,
we have a new skill, which is not like. You know, like when young people think something's good and they say it's a bit skill. It's not that. It's not that. It's an actual skill, an Alexa skill, an Empire Alexa skill, which you can get off the, the skill store,
the Alexa.
Otherwise known as Amazon. Yeah. And it means that you can have your daily briefing from you know, as well as proper journalists and news outlets like the BBC, you can get them from us as well. And you can hear Chris in your ear every morning at 7 banging on about some old shit.
7.
I highly recommend you don't. But
before
if you
8.
Choose to. Yeah, you're lucky if you get it at 7.
Yeah, before
because you're
8.
Off running somewhere.
Well, this is the thing, right? So I'm doing this Alexa business now. So I get up every morning and it's not a podcast. Let's just disabuse people of that notion. It's a very, very brief trawl through the day's movie news. So it's me going, here's what's happened for film news, and then talking about it. But I do it sometimes I'm in my pants, sometimes I'm fully nude. And so I want you to be able to listen to, you know, as you listen to Alexa briefings every day, see if you can guess from the tone of my voice which times I'm fully clothed, which times I'm semi-clothed, and which times I'm completely and utterly in the buff.
Can we have a special code for our readers where you use a certain adjective to denote the level of undress that you're doing it in?
I imagine Helen
is shaking her head just like, this is not happening.
Just as, I mean, not just as a lawyer, as a human being.
As a citizen of
Helen,
the
surely,
let's not.
Surely you remember the good old days of Naked News.
I do remember the good old days of Naked News, and I distinctly remember not wanting to know about nudity at the time.
Should we, have we tell people?
We have,
I don't think we have.
Have we never naked news on the podcast before?
Must
have.
Let's not now.
Okay,
we should.
If everyone remembers
this.
The early noughties and a thing called MSN, which is the Microsoft Instant Messaging program, we used to do news at home for the website before coming into work. And we would get on the little instant messenger thing, me and Helen and Chris and a few other people, and chat about what we were right about. And we would mention the fact that we just got up and Chris would be undressed.
Why me?
I mean
none of the
you.
Rest of us were claiming to be
you.
Naked.
Yeah.
I didn't claim to be naked. Well, that claim has been made for me by him.
You claimed... I thought you were just claiming to be nude? Do you consider it more artistic if it's nude?
I only do it if it's gratuitous.
I am not naked, madam. I am nude.
I'd like to just make clear, because I'm not 100% sure it was, we were all in different places when we were on MSN.
Yes. Were you?
Oh, were the rest of you just in one giant bed? Never mind, I don't want to know.
Can we just make it absolutely clear? We do not live together.
No. Yeah. In a big Empire house.
Or I'd love an Empire
Wouldn't
bus.
Wouldn't it be great?
Wouldn't you love that? Like a proper tour bus. It just drives around London and we all live on it in bunk beds. And we all...
With a big sign on the side saying like 300 million to the podcast.
Yeah, we're all super film friends.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be good.
Every single day.
Top bunk, shotgun.
James wants a top bunk and the shotgun.
Yeah, that's it.
I will take the bottom bunk and a sword. Helen, what are you left with? You're left with the beanie bag.
I'd like a shield, please. A vibranium one, ideally.
An agent of, yeah.
Oh, that would also work, yeah. Mm.
A Clark Gregg. Oh, God, I love Greggs, don't you?
Oh, I love Greggs. Love a cheese and onion
pasty. Can you tell we don't have a question?
Has nothing come through yet?
Something's come through.
It's been about 5 minutes.
All right, okay. So here's
we're doing this live. This is almost like a live podcast.
Here's, speaking of which, I'll plug that later on. We had a question for the podcast, and then James went, no, we've just answered that a couple months ago. So whenever I wasn't here, so I didn't realise that. So I've asked very quickly on Twitter as we're doing this for... Oh, by the way, didn't they even say what I was doing? The Alexa thing. So the Alexa thing, I'm getting up really early in the morning, right? And so I thought to myself, I'm going to get back into the running. Because last year I did a 10K. It pales in comparison, obviously, to Helen's marathons. She's running one now.
And I did sign up for one just before you got here. It's on Sunday.
What? Signed up for one that's on Sunday?
I mean, I didn't.
Because your body is in a state of readiness.
Is this?
I mean, readiness is a really strong word for my body, but... You know, I figured, hey, why not?
Okay, here we go. Here we go. Joshua Lawson asks, best Jaws movie?
Well, sure. Okay.
Let me be the controversial one to say it. I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to overturn years of accepted wisdom and say Jaws.
Yeah, it's controversial. Although, if I'm honest with you, when I was a wee child, I really liked Jaws 2 because it was fluffier and funnier.
I mean, sharks shouldn't be fluffy.
Yeah, I know, but I was a kid. Mm. I liked that they had their little party on the boat and they lashed them all together and made a makeshift raft.
Out of sharks?
Well, no, it was made out of boats, but the shark did its best to kind of,
Oh, I see. Okay.
Undo their work.
Mm. Darn sharks.
Yeah.
In movies. In real life, they're not so bad.
Those crazy sharks. A lot of these questions are ones that would actually take a lot of time to prepare. So let's not talk about those and let's instead go with, best Jaws movie. And someone has written in, replied to Joshua Lawson at a Josh of Note on Twitter and thrown a bit of a curveball.
Which is?
Moonraker.
I mean, Moonraker is objectively not better than Jaws, so it's not quite as good as I think it is, but I see what they did there.
It's also not the best Bond movie featuring Jaws.
No, it's not.
That's The Spy Who Loved Me. Now, is The Spy Who Loved Me better than Jaws?
No.
No. Right, so if you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter, where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see your tweet. Tweet it with the respect it deserves. We're on Facebook as well, Empire Magazine. And we're on email, where we're podcast at empireonline.com. Okay, we've got a lot of guests this week. This is entirely my fault because I forgot the next week we're doing a live podcast as part of the London Podcast Festival at King's Place. Some tickets are still available, so go onto the website www.kingsplace.co.uk to book your tickets. Come along next Friday evening and see us three giggling idiots and Terry White have a whale of a time.
If, speaking of whales, I mean... Not really, but if this helps people to buy tickets if they haven't already, I will be giving away, among other things, a giant fuck-off stuffed shark. I will be bestowing that upon someone in the audience. I mean, it's not a whale, but you see, I needed a bridge and that seemed to work. So, yeah, I will be carrying this huge shark down to the event and someone will win it.
If it had been a whale shark, you might have been on.
Oh, yes, that would have been good. But it's not.
No, it's got teeth.
It's a megalodon.
Mm. Is this a brand new one, or is this one of the ones that we have?
It's a brand new one. It's a brand new one. It's being donated.
Yeah, that I will flump down on and have a little.
No, I'm not making the comfort sharks from the office. That would be. No, that's not happening.
Genuinely more comfortable than my mattress.
I mean, they're amazing.
Right.
Yeah, they are amazing. We flop down on them quite regularly.
Not together.
No,
it has to be said. Two of those bad boys on top of each other, and you're on a one way ticket to Snooze Town. It's absolutely amazing. Mm. So anyway, because I forgot that we're doing the live podcast next week, loads of films are coming out next week, and I said yes to all these guests, and then we can't put them in the live podcast, and so we have to put them in this week's podcast. So we had four guests.
Okay.
Lee Whannell, the director of Upgrade, which we'll be talking about later on, came in at the weekend. We had an absolute blast, and so that's going to go up as a special. So that should be up around about the time that you're listening to this. But we got three guests this week, and so the first guest is Tombola. Chloe Grace Moretz.
Hey!
Hey! Chloe Grace Moretz.
Who stars in The Miseducation of Cameron Poe.
St-
it's possible I've misunderstood this film.
Yes. Which film were you watching, by the way?
I don't know, but Oscar Isaac's hair was great.
Yeah. Yes. When James reviews our film next week in a live podcast, he talks about the bunny back in the box. Oh, and
Cyrus the Virus.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So she shot the fame, obviously, as Hit Girl in Kick-Ass. She's been in all sorts of movies ever since, including the remake of Carrie. What else? Has she
Let
been
me
in?
In.
You're already here, Helen.
Hey. There we go. I'm so sorry.
I couldn't miss it. Open goal. So it's a remake of Carrie and Let Me In and The Fifth Wave. And she's a really fascinating actress and is a lot of fun in this interview. Miseducation of Cameron Post is a very serious movie about a young girl who is taken to a gay re-education camp in the States because her guardian disapproves of her being a lesbian. So here you go. Chloe Grace Moretz. Enjoy. Fantastic. All right. Should we rock and roll?
Yeah, let's hit it.
Let's do this thing.
DJ,
this,
play that back.
This crazy. I wish I could be a DJ.
Well, you know.
Is that
never
a strange
say
wish?
Never.
That's a strange
no,
wish.
No, not
it?
At all. I mean, I tend to DJ every party that, you know.
Oh, really?
My family throws the house, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, on this movie, we would have a party every. We work 6 day weeks.
Uh huh.
23 day shoot. The most brutal.
Okay.
But we would have every Saturday night we had off and then Sunday morning. And so every single Saturday night, every single one, I would have the phone plugged in and I'd be DJing and Sasha would be dancing.
Oh, wow.
And we would throw these little dance parties to let loose.
What was on the playlist?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it was really all over the place. But I think, you know, the main heavy hitter is always Missy Elliott.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Big one. TLC, Destiny's Child.
All right, good stuff.
Yeah.
And is this a playlist that you had collated, or did you just stick Spotify on random?
No. This is like, I sit there and I like dance while having the phone in my hand so I can choose the next song. And then I like cue them up. Yeah.
I'd be a terrible DJ like that if I had to go to parties and DJ because my tastes lie towards the maudlin guitar stuff.
Oh,
you know.
Well, you know, you got to read your crowd. That's the whole part of being a DJ.
Yeah.
You got to like read the crowd.
Now
you got to figure out
me.
What the age ranges are, see who's going to like what, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And play for the masses.
I don't know about that. I think I need to bludgeon people with my music.
Oh,
like,
that's
this
a
is
good
what
idea.
You are going to
You're
listen to what
like
I
this.
Like. That's it.
It's like Korn, and everyone's like, whoa, dude, heavy choice.
That's a bit too heavy. We have a thing at Empire we do every week called Song Wars, where everybody in the office chooses a song that they champion. And this week's theme was anger.
And so fun.
It wasn't
what
fun.
What was your choice?
Well, my choice was Ben Folds 5. I went for upbeat piano ditty.
Okay.
But it's a song. It's called Song for the Dumped. Check it out if you can. Okay. Afterwards, I get royalties. So check it out. But it's a nice jaunty one, but it's a breakup song. So it's full of anger. But there was some. There was some Slipknot. There was some Korn. There was some Nine Inch Nails.
I was about to say, I would probably choose some Slipknot or Korn. It's not really aggressive.
It wasn't fun. We were on press and everyone was just on edge and getting a little bit. No, it wasn't
You're like,
fun.
I need to leave this zone. I need to go home now.
Yeah, precisely. I need to curl up under my desk.
I need to go away.
With
this
some
is a
noise
bad
cancelling
idea.
Headphones.
Yeah.
Precisely. But the DJ I meant that I would like to be at this late stage of my life was like a radio DJ because there's one thing I want to do more than
this
anything in my life.
BBC Radio 1. And
I want to throw to the weather
capital.
People.
Yeah.
I want to go, and who's up in the whirly bird
now
today?
Now what's going on over there? And bring it back. Yeah. That's my interpretation.
That's an accent that's been honed over years.
This has been years of listening to Capital while driving to work here in England.
Yeah.
This is Capital FM, the morning show.
Well, strictly speaking, this building, you should be talking about Absolute, a Magic and Kiss. Capital, that's the other company, so we don't do that.
I'm so sorry.
But what's it like being back in London? Are you okay? Are you finding old haunts?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you know, it's... I literally grew up here for a period of time. I lived here from 11 to 15. And I remember when I was younger, people used to think that I was a British actress. Like, I had more people being like, so you grew up here. And I'm like, no, just on a lot of British things. I love London. I love it, especially this time of year. It's so pretty. Yeah. It's nice. I'm stuck here in Piccadilly Circus, which is not awesome.
No, that's not awesome. It's a bit of a tourist trap.
It's a bit, to say the least, I'd say.
But it's fine. You learned to swerve last year and less stuff. In time. But you were here to talk about The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
Yeah, fantastic film.
Not DJing, amazingly, but I always bring it back to the movie eventually. We'll get there.
It might be in the end.
Yeah.
It might be the last 10 minutes.
But we'll get there. So The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Thanks, Chloe Grace.
Thank you. Go see it.
It is in cinemas now. When did you film this movie? About a year and a half ago?
Yeah, we filmed it right over the election, which was...
Oh, wow.
What, November? November 2016? So we filmed it November 2016.
Scarily long time ago.
A shocking amount of time.
Yeah.
The things that can happen.
Yes.
In a year and a half.
I'm surprised that a certain someone is still in a certain job at this point in time.
Yeah, he who shall not be named.
Yeah, I'm mainly talking about me, but
God.
But the other fella as well. The other guy.
Yeah, the orange fella.
Yeah. So you were filming on election day as well, is that right?
Yeah, so we shot the movie, like I said, over 23 days, under $1 million, real shotgun shoot. We shot it chronologically at the summer camp where we actually filmed the movie. We were living there. So it was a very immersive process, to say the least. But on the day which we filmed this scene where I have to jump on the table and sing the Four Non-Blondes karaoke moment, which is probably the highest, like, it's the most elated moment in the film. That was the day we found out who our president-elect was. So it was a really interesting juxtaposition to have to give that much, you know, excitement and happiness and elation to a moment in which we were so much so in mourning.
Yeah.
But it was very much, you know, it harkened back to the story of the oppression and the feeling of that latent sadness and how, you know, the characters needed that moment as much as we did that day. So it was really beautiful.
But it's also a film in which your character, Cameron Post, obviously, internalizes a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it is a very internal performance as a result of that. And you know, it must have been interesting then to have these moments where you do get to let go and give voice to those frustrations that are building up inside. Especially, I guess, when you're, as you say, shotgun shoot, 23 days, all the emotions must be intensified.
Yeah, it was combustive for sure. Yeah. It is hard doing a character that is so quiet. I love doing those type of characters, you know, as you can tell with Let Me In and the various projects I've done as a kid till now. I live for those characters that show more through subtext than actually speaking and vocalizing their issues. So it really, this movie, you know, really catered to me in that sense that I was able to react instead of, you know, be the propelling force in a lot of ways. So it was a wonderful opportunity, but it was combustive to say the least. I mean, I would go home with so much like pent up emotion, but then I would kind of put it in perspective and think about how these conversion therapy camps are real.
Yeah.
And the amount of oppression and suppression that these kids are feeling on a daily basis. I was feeling 1/18th of what they were going through.
And this film's set in 1993, but these things are still around.
Very much so.
They still exist. How much did you know about them going into this? Before you got the script, I think everyone's vaguely aware that this is a thing.
I mean, I grew up in the Bible Belt of America. I mean, I grew up in Georgia in a small town. We grew up Christian Baptist, which is very, you know, Southern Baptist is one of the most conservative. So we grew up in a town where praying the gay away, as they call it and refer to it, was very real. You know, it was the idea that being gay is a choice and that choice is to live a life of sin. And that was something that was inherent and latent in our community. So obviously, as I grew up under that umbrella, and we eventually moved to Los Angeles, and my brothers came out as gay, two of them, it changed a lot of the perspective in our family, and that conservative, strict umbrella we grew up under started to crumble.
It's
interesting making this movie and educating myself onto the realities of specifically conversion therapy, because I was aware of praying the gay away and the idea that, you know, being gay is a choice, not the way you're born, but I wasn't aware of these camps, especially the modernity of the issue. And it wasn't until I started the rehearsal process that I found it pertinent, obviously, to meet survivors of conversion therapy in real life. And the five survivors I met were in their mid-20s. They had been in it since they were 16, and they had been in there for about 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
And I was just so taken aback by the youth of it and the different socioeconomic backgrounds, the different nationalities, the different religions, some of which were put into this conversion therapy for reasons that weren't religious at all. And I just, you know, I guess I was faced with the reality that there is no face of conversion therapy, obviously, because there's no face of being gay. There's no one stereotype. So, yeah, the research was, I mean, for me, it was mind-blowing.
And then, of course, going back to Election Day, and the Vice President of the United States of America has...
Who advocates for...
Conversion therapy. That's got to be an interesting situation at the moment for you guys over there.
Yeah, I mean, to say the least, you have a vice president and an administration, you know, that across the board is trying to strip away all the different laws that we've had in place over the last several years now that protect LGBT people. They're trying to strip those away. But in particular, we have a vice president who advocates for conversion therapy and helped funnel research from AIDS into conversion therapy progress. So, the hypocrisy there is pretty shocking. And then, you know, the statistics stand for themselves. 700,000 people have been through conversion therapy in America. 77,000 teens will go through conversion therapy in the next 5 years. It's illegal in 14 states, but only for minors. It is legal in every state in America, the practice of conversion therapy, which is insidious and much more real and pertinent in America than you'd think it is.
That's horrifying. And in fact, I mean, the movie itself is obviously a drama, but watching it, I did feel at times that it was almost a horror movie.
Oh yeah, there's some moments. I mean, it's a comedy drama.
Yeah,
it finds the inherent laughter in the hypocrisy of someone facing you with what they're saying. But there are moments when you know, if you really boil it down and you really listen to what's happening and the conditioning that they're doing to these young people, yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
It's really, really disgusting.
And it's also a movie on one level about taking control of your life and taking control of your choices as well. And I think, you know, first time I met you was on Kick-Ass
years ago
when you were doing the butterfly knife stuff. Absolutely. And
that must be funny for you.
It's very, I feel I have never felt older, if I'm completely honest. This is a very strange experience.
I was so little.
You were so little.
I was like here.
You know, obviously you've been acting your entire life.
Yeah.
Going into acting as a kid, what drove you, and has that changed over the years? You know, was there a point where you thought, well, is this something I'm just doing because I like it or I'm good at it or because I can make a career of it?
I mean, I always just thought, honestly, I just thought it was fun when I was younger. I knew how to evoke emotion and depict it, and I enjoyed that. It was so fun to cry or to show fear or to show happiness or anger. And I loved playing with my emotions like a little puppeteer. Like I really thought that was incredibly fun. It wasn't until I was about 13 when I asked my mother and brother, and I was like, "Oh, you know, it's gonna be a bummer when I have to get like a real job one day." I literally remember being like, "You know, my friends are gonna go off to college, and we're all gonna go off to college one day, and this has been really fun, but it's not like a reality." And that was the first moment when they were like, "Oh, what? This is a career. Like, people can do this for a living." And that was the first time when I realized that I don't have to quit this. So that was a big shift for me at like 13 when I realized I could make a career out of what I was doing and I wasn't just clowning around.
Yeah.
But that perspective changed again when I was, you know, about 19. And having made, you know, I've made about 63 movies now, worked for 15 years.
Wow.
But for the first time, I wasn't unhappy with the content I had put out, but I felt the flame that had always been within me, this driving force to always make movies and to just make them, you know, as much as possible as I can, sometimes 8 movies a year. For the first time, I felt it dwindle, and that terrified me.
Oh, really?
Because,
okay.
Well, because this, making movies and being an actor is who I am. It's one and the same with my skin. I mean, it's how I live and breathe. And so to feel this kind of shock of when I look in the mirror and I don't quite recognize who I am as Chloe, I knew that something was wrong. And that's when I had to quit. And I pulled out of the movies that I was in, and I took a year and a half off of acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat back and I reassessed who I was and what I wanted to be and what content meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
And how, even though I'd been making really great projects sometimes and all of them that I'm proud of, I was overspending and I was in the negative. And I
emotionally or...
Yeah, I was unfulfilled emotionally because I wasn't truly choosing projects that put that, you know, tinder into the fire and kept it going.
Mm.
I was just running out of resources pretty much, even though I wasn't even connecting to it. And it's because I wasn't really connecting to that inner dialogue. And through sitting alone and reading and listening to different movies and podcasts and just immersing myself in situations that I hadn't had the time to and being alone, that I started to realize who I was and what it was that I wanted to be doing. And this is the first movie that I did off the back of that break. And then the next one was Suspiria with Luca Guadagnino.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, what I realized it came down to was obviously stories, but first and foremost, filmmakers that
yes.
had a certain perspective that could view me differently
mm-hmm.
and view a story differently.
That's interesting.
Take a chance.
Especially given the directors that you've worked with in your career up
yeah.
until now. I mean, no slackers.
No.
in there. You know, Soderbergh is in there.
Yeah.
What's his name? Oh, Scorsese.
Yeah, yeah. He's small, young director.
He's,
yeah.
What would he ever amount to?
I don't know. Is it like 2 hits?
that,
like,
barely. barely.
What is
movie
that?
Movie about a taxi driver. Yeah. Who wants
what
to see that?
Who wants to see that?
Just a guy driving around.
That's
rubbish.
That's dumb.
Stupid.
It's dumb.
So
the guy driving around.
But then that's what it is. That's my understanding, anyway. Then you come back and you're immediately working, as you say, with Luca Guadagnino. What's new about that situation then? What's new? What's new about you in Suspiria that he found?
Well, I guess there was no preconceived notion of who, in his eyes, Chloe Grace Moretz was,
yeah.
which I feel like is a more modern thing for me. From the time I was probably about 15, I started becoming faced with that.
Yeah.
With this, just this representation and this kind of projection of who I'm supposed to be, or what people expected me to act as, in what roles they expected me to act in. And Desi and Luca didn't question for once that I could take on these characters. But not only did they not question it, they were not afraid of me saying, like, I don't want to do anything like I've done before.
Mm.
And I want people to not look at it and go, oh, it's Chloe Grace Moretz in another movie. I want them to see Cameron Post. I want them to see Patricia. And I want them to be immersed in the character, not me.
Yeah.
And that anonymity, which I felt like I lost,
yeah,
be
of
it
course.
For whatever reason, you know what I mean? But that anonymity that I lost, I wanted to regain that within myself and finding characters and fitting myself into characters' skin that felt uncomfortable.
Yes, of course.
And figuring out what that feels like.
If you hadn't decided to come back, what was your backup plan?
Taxi driving.
Just driving around.
Just driving around.
In a
you
big
know,
old circle.
Put up a GoPro, see what happens.
You come to London. Become a taxi driver.
That
you got the
so
you got the
tight.
Accent down pat. Listen to Capital all day. What the hell is that about? And then just pick
no,
people up and drive around.
God no.
Yeah. Except
Capital.
London taxi drivers. You know about the knowledge, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, they have to know every single street in London. I mean, that's
good
just
luck.
That's just crazy. It's
mean,
impossible.
I feel like I know a fair amount. I feel like I know it better than some.
You know, but, all the squares of the Monopoly board, and that's
it. Squares.
That's it.
I can get myself around. I don't know the street names, but I can definitely get myself around. Watch this.
One last thing. I spoke to Matthew Vaughan recently, who said that he is launching his own studio, Marv Studios. And we were talking about potential projects, and there's lots of Kingsman stuff going on. He also said that he is looking at either doing a Hit Girl prequel.
I don't even know what that means.
I think it means like a four-year-old killing people. As far as I can tell.
How do you get a prequel from an 11-year-old? I'm just wondering how that goes.
Well, cast someone younger, obviously.
But like, you're going like 6 years old?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah,
cool.
Okay. So, or...
I got it. Okay.
Or he might pick up with Mindy as she
Mindle?
Is now. Yeah. And see what's happened. Would you be interested?
If Matthew directed it, and if Matthew did it, yeah. I wouldn't do it with anyone else. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that was part of... I think some of the issues with the second movie is just that we didn't have Matt's stamp on it, and I trust Matt implicitly. I think he's a really smart filmmaker, and you know, I think he's the reason that Kick-Ass 1 hit that tone on the head that no one else could have done, and he was able to, you know, give Hit Girl a platform that I think is incredibly iconic for who she is. But I wouldn't do it with anyone else. So maybe, yeah.
Let's get him on the phone. See,
but only with Matthew.
That's legally binding. Fantastic. Chloe Grace Moretz, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to throw the weather now. It's been
okay,
a lot of fun.
Okay, what's going up in the heli today?
What's happening in the whirly bit today?
What's going up in the whirly bit today?
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, that was Chloe Grace Moretz. Time now for the movie news. Hell's Bells.
Can we start with the non-story that isn't a story anymore?
Is this the news that you're going to be playing Thomas Wayne?
It is, yes. So at the beginning of the week, Alec Baldwin was said to be planned to star in the Joker film as Thomas Wayne, father
Just to be clear,
of Bruce.
Which Joker film?
Oh, I apologize. The one that's a prequel set during the 80s. I don't know. It has Martin Scorsese involved.
Right.
Right. So the Joker film I want to say Jared Leto, but I'm not going to. It's Joaquin Phoenix.
Yes.
I've got this. Yes. So he was apparently going to be playing Thomas Wayne, father of Bruce, as a Trump monkey, was the way he put it in a later tweet.
Oh, I completely mispronounced it on Alexa this morning. I had no idea it was pronounced monkey. I went monk. But there's no accent. So how would you know?
In fairness, he left off the accent on his tweet, which is his bad, not yours.
Baldwin! You know? That's a bald lose, if
what's
you ask me.
What's a Trump monk?
Monkey. It means like he's not even Trump. Like he missed the goal of being Trump. He wants to be Trump, but isn't.
I've never heard of this word. Are you sure you haven't invented it?
Monk. Monque. It's not a monk who behaves or looks like Donald Trump, which is what you're thinking. I could see it in your head. Monks have better hair than Donald Trump. Anyway.
Yeah, they do, actually. The tonsure can be much better looking. Right. So here's the thing. That is, I think... And I realize this has been done in the comics. There is some precedent for this. But I think this is an appalling idea for a Thomas Wayne. First of all, why on earth would we need another Thomas Wayne to appear in any further Batman film? If there is anyone on the planet who is not aware that Batman's father was killed and that's one of the things that made him Batman, I hope you have fun under your rock. But really, the rest of us are aware of it and we don't need to see it again. So that's point one for me. Point two, if Thomas Wayne is a con man and a crook, which is what this story basically suggested, how does that square with Batman's lifelong mission? What are we thinking? I don't get it. I don't understand. Now, I've heard one good possible explanation of this, and that is that the whole film is seen through the skewed lens of the Joker, and that this is his view of what Thomas Wayne must have been, because that's the only thing he can imagine. That is literally the only thing that makes any possible sense for me. But even then, I don't understand why we need any Thomas Wayne in any further movie.
It's like having Uncle Ben be an absolute douchebag.
Oh God! Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
They're not douchebags. They're boiling the bags, and that's a completely different thing.
And you really don't want to get those mixed up, I guess. Right?
You shot my Uncle Ben. There's rice everywhere, you bastards. That was my lunch.
So anyway, it then emerged by the end of the week that actually Alec Baldwin won't be starring in the film. We don't know if someone else will in the same role. We don't know if the role has been cut because everybody went, oh, this is a terrible idea. But either way,
it was
a big story about nothing.
Yeah. As he said in a follow-up quote to the US, to the USA Today, he said 25 guys could play that role. I like Alec Baldwin a lot. He's got a very good podcast. Listen to it if you want to check it out. It's called Here's the Thing. It's called Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin. He's got that great voice, hasn't he?
He has a great voice.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's not Nick Offerman,
so
but it's pretty darn good.
I don't know. Would you take that? I mean, if they had a voice off, that'd be amazing. But anyway.
Whoever wins, we all win.
We all win. Yeah, it'd be like drowning in syrup. Glorious syrup.
What is happening?
Anyway, yeah, I can kind of see. I don't think it was a good idea, but I don't think that they're going to stop. I think they're just going to cast someone else.
Oh, sure.
And we shall see what happens. I have concerns about the timeline. I don't think that we'll see Bruce Wayne turn into Batman in this movie. But if the Joker is already played by a 40-something-year-old man in the 1980s and he's hanging out with Thomas Wayne, then what age is he going to be when Batman finally gets his bat L plates off the Batmobile and starts tearing it up?
Uh-huh. Just one of the many, many, many things that doesn't make a lot of sense on the face of it.
I was on the Twitter this week.
Oh, God.
And while I was on the Twitter, looking at, you know, skill things on the Twitter, there was someone had sort of dash cam footage of someone being pulled over by the police. And they were pulled over on the freeway. And then as they pulled out and overtook the police car, you saw what they'd pulled over. And they had pulled over an 80s Keaton-era Batmobile with the driver in full Keaton bat suit having a very heated conversation with the traffic officer. And it was the greatest thing that's ever been on the internet.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Well done.
So
I saw Bill Nighy on the way here.
Was he wearing a bat suit?
No, he was wearing a suit, though. He was crossing Piccadilly. And it all felt very on-brand for Bill Nighy.
Well, not in any way related to Bill Nighy, but there's been some Walking Dead things happening this week.
Yes, tell me more.
There's been a new trailer, which is, you know, fine. But that's not the exciting thing. The exciting thing for me is that Ryan Hurst is going to be appearing in the new series, and this will mean very little to most people, but this was Opie from Sons of Anarchy, and I've missed him, and I don't know what he's been doing since he took a lead pipe to the head in Sons of Anarchy. But
spoiler.
He's going to be... Spoiler. He's going to be playing Beta, who is one of the Whisperers, and Samantha Morton, who's already been cast, is playing Alpha, who... I'm sure you can work out, is in charge of the Whisperers. The Whisperers are people who wear the skins of zombies on their faces.
But why? That sounds gross.
I mean, it is a bit weird, and they're not particularly well-adjusted members of, you know, post-apocalyptic society. But, you know, it's a thing.
Each to their own, I suppose.
Yeah, so this is going to be the post-Lincoln, post-Rick era. So we'll see how this all pans out. I'm quite interested to see the new series of Walking Dead, and that's something I haven't said in about 6 years. But I feel now that they've got through the whole, you know, Negan all-out war thing, although Negan is still around, hopefully it'll get good again.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how they get rid of Rick.
Yeah.
I really hope they don't just kill him.
So do I. I think he deserves better than that.
Yeah. I hope he gets to walk off in the sunset and then get eaten.
Or
off camera, obviously, because no one...
He gets killed in the first episode and spends the next 3 or 4 episodes as a zombie.
Sometimes they'll have a character be bitten and then that character will get 3 or 4 episodes to say goodbye to everybody. If it's a very slow-moving wound and they got the fever. But I hope that doesn't happen. I hope he gets some happiness. And this is a show in which everyone dies. Just let someone live for once in a while, you
bastards. But isn't the point
of
it basically nihilism?
Yeah.
Like, there is no...
No, that's Frasier. Oh, that's Nihilism.
That's Nihilism.
That's Nihilism. There's a couple of things this week that excited me. One is confirmation that there will indeed be a sequel to A Quiet Place.
You're not for a while.
Yes, not due until 2020.
Mm.
So.
And also, Top Gun is not feeling the need for speed, and that's gone back to the same year, both 2020.
Yeah, so, well, obviously that they want to keep those two apart, though, you would have thought, because the sonic booms, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Yeah.
2020. So what do we think? Nothing else has been revealed about A Quiet Place, apart from the date. We don't know whether it's going to pick up where the last film left off. We don't know whether John Krasinski is going to come back. I would suspect not.
I would suspect not. I think he had an idea. He told us that he had an idea for the sequel before this one was even finished shooting. So I don't think it's you know, this is not a hastily thrown together thing. He had that kind of outline, that notion at least in his mind already. So hopefully it's a strong enough hook for a full film.
Do you think they're aiming for 2020 because when you can't make any noise, eyesight is really important?
Yes.
Yes, as do I.
So we're going to call it A Quiet Place, colon, 2020 vision?
Yeah.
Is that what we're going to call it?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's official.
It might be sent to the submarine, as we pitched him on the spoiler special, as we pitched to John Krasinski, and you could tell he loved that idea. So I think Quiet Place 2, Run Silent, Run Deep.
Quiet Place 2, yeah. The Hunt for Red October.
Excited about that. We talk about Dwayne Johnson an awful lot in this podcast, and quite often I will say I'm disappointed that he doesn't seem to be pushing himself as an actor, and he doesn't hook up with A-list directors. He seems to be doing that. A new film has been announced this week. It's called The King. He's not going to be playing Elvis Presley. Instead, he's going to be playing an incredibly important historical figure in the birth or in the bringing together, the joining together of Hawaii and its different islands. King Kamehameha, which I
did that quite well. I was waiting for the car crash that would have been
up
that.
Today and heard someone else pronounce it that way. So if my pronunciation is incorrect, then please yell at YouTube. So, what do you think of this? This is going to be directed by Robert Zemeckis. It's going to be written by Randall Wallace, who, of course, wrote the screenplay for Braveheart. He may have won an Oscar for that. I need to double check. But this is certainly Dwayne Johnson playing a role that apparently he's wanted to play for decades.
Mm. Well, yeah. I mean, one of the major figures of Polynesian history, right?
I mean, absolutely.
Oceanic history. So that does make sense for him, I think. Is this live action, not animation?
Live action.
Live action. That's good, because I think there's no need for it to be animated. I think it's cool. I just think it's a part of the world that we don't see very often on screen, so especially not live action. And we don't very often hear from oceanic people, you know, as protagonists. They've kind of been the background to, you know, white explorers' stories.
Hi, Moana.
Yeah, but exactly. But that was like a big deal, and that was like a first. And I feel like this is maybe a kind of corrective in the same direction. So I think that's very good. I'm really intrigued by just that whole part of the world, like the whole Pacific, the whole of it. Mm. And so I'm excited to see what happens with this.
Sounds to me like someone's angling for a set visit.
I would like a set visit. I've always wanted to go to Hawaii, but
sounds good. If he doesn't sing "You're Welcome," I don't want to know.
I will. No, come on. You're always here for The Rock, as am I, James.
I am. It's true. In fact, speaking of which, you talked a little bit about Big Trouble in Little China as well this week, about how it's going to be a sequel.
I think it was someone else talked about that, but not him. But,
was it not him?
It wasn't him.
Well, someone talked about
it. It was someone else. It was an executive in charge of the film said it's going to be a sequel, which means, of course, that there is a potential for Jack Burton to return in the guise of Kurt Russell. I nearly said Jack Russell in the guise of Kurt Burton.
Well, that would be interesting.
I managed to catch myself, otherwise I could have been pretty embarrassing. Ooh. But our little secret, eh, listeners?
Also very exciting.
It's all in the reflexes.
And a huge sci-fi crossover. The Doctor is joining Episode 9. Matt Smith, the Doctor minus one, is going to be part of the cast of Star Wars.
A Doctor, surely.
A Doctor. No, The Doctor. They're all The Doctor.
Ah, The Doctor.
Ah, The Doctor. Is joining the Star Wars Episode 9. We don't know what he's going to be playing. Internet fan fiction prefers either A, the Doctor, or B, some kind of love interest / best buddy for Hux, because they could be fabulously pantomimed together.
He's absolutely playing an Imperial Bastard, isn't he?
Yeah, I think Imperial
Bastard. Or First Order Bastard.
Imperial Bastard is a good guess. But to be honest, we all should have seen this coming, and I'll tell you why. Because the new Star Wars trilogy has been slowly but steadily gathering the actors with the best hair for years. And we should have known that Matt Smith would end up there, because he's got that gigantic mop. And it's only a matter of time before Andrew Lincoln follows. Andrew Garfield and Andrew Lincoln, well, who cares?
All the Andrews. And Empire's John Nugent. I mean, all of them.
All of them? Mm. Yeah, all the hair.
You think Matt Smith has the best hair?
I think Matt Smith has extremely bountiful, bouncy hair.
Does he have the best Doctor hair?
No.
You know my Doctor is David Tennant, so...
Your Doctor's David Tennant?
The Doctor is David Tennant.
I'm saying
my
he's
doctor.
Follically inferior.
I think he might want to check his credentials, Helen. I don't think he's medically qualified.
But I think he can do anything. He's travelled through space and time. He must have picked some stuff up. Okay. And a sonic screwdriver will do wonders for your sore back.
There are so many punchlines here, and I am trying. I am trying so hard to be a better person.
Fight the good fight, Chris.
I am going to fight the good fight. The best Doctor Who hair. All right,
Baker.
Baker, yeah, Tom.
Absolutely
Baker.
Baker.
Which one? Which Baker?
Tom.
Tom Baker.
You think Tom Baker?
Yeah.
Tom Baker has the best hair.
How do you get past Tom Baker's hair?
Yeah.
Like it's the most iconic.
He's 80% hair.
He's more hair now than man.
It's true.
Twisted and curly.
Why are you taking a dump? on John Pertwee's hair. Why are you ignoring the claims of the Pertwee?
Pertwee.
John Pertwee, good hair. Tom Baker, good hair. Colin Baker, hair. Peter Davison, hair. Capaldi, come on, guys. Now, I'm not a big Doctor Who fan, but you gotta look at that and think that is a landmark of coiffure. Is it coiffed landmark? Well,
Jodie Whittaker has significantly more hair than most other doctors, so...
No, but it's
not about
just
volume of hair.
Yeah, it's not just about volume. It's also about, like, you know, the way it's deployed.
It's what they do with it that counts.
William Hartnell had a lot of hair, but I didn't like it. Even though my hair is approaching that kind of style, even now, I'm letting it grow out. It doesn't look good. Anyway, Jodie Whittaker, yeah, good hair, but Capaldi.
Capaldi had good hair, but I have to say, I like Tennant's hair. It's very, very sticky up. I'm now looking at a picture of all the doctors.
The thing is, Doctor Who is dreadful, so who cares?
How dare you?
I'm sorry, I can't get on board with it. I won't get on board with it, and you can't make me. Farscape for the win.
What is Doctor Who?
I rest my case, my lud.
What does Doctor Who get his hair cut? Cyber cuts. It's like super cuts, but
that's terrible.
It's not
cyber.
I don't think it's even a joke.
No, you got nothing.
I've got nothing.
Okay, there's nothing about Daleks. No.
No.
Got no Davros. No. Nothing. Okay. Good. Good talk. This has been fun.
I feel like I went into that blind. I didn't really know where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. 2020 vision, that's what you need. Like Should a quiet place too.
Sorry, I'll cut this bit out. It's fine. I'll just save my blushes. Let's talk about the London Film Festival.
Oh, yes. Very exciting. The lineup was announced this morning. Sadly, I couldn't go along. I say sadly because they always have pastry. But it's looking like a fantastic lineup. It opens with Widows, which is brilliant, the new Steve McQueen movie, always exciting. And it closes with Stan and Ollie, which is the, obviously, Laurel and Hardy film, also really exciting. And in between, we just got a wealth of good stuff. Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the new Coen Brothers film.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even tell you what I want to see because there's too many stuff.
There's too many stuff.
Look, that's a phrase. It's very late on a Thursday. I'm very tired. And my shoulders hurt. There's an Empire gala, of course, an Empire-sponsored gala of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which is exciting.
I'm incredibly optimistic about it, Helen.
Are you?
Yeah, almost quixotic.
Oh, I walked into that one. I should have known better.
I still won't believe that's an actual film until I've seen it. And even then, I'm not sure that I will believe that it's an actual film. Because Terry Gilliam's been trying to get this film made probably for longer than any of us have been alive, and has had so many false starts. And now here it is. It played at Cannes, so I think it's a real film.
But there was some legal stuff around it at Cannes, so that must have been, presumably that must have been sorted out if it's now coming to London.
Or maybe we're just being mavericks. Anyway, so it's going to be the Laugh Gala at the LFF.
The Laugh Gala, yes.
The Man Who Killed Don Quixote with Adam Driver. Now, he's got good hair.
He does.
I mean, he's your quintessential great hair, isn't he?
Yeah. And Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, also in the festival, The Favourite, the new one from Yorgos Lanthimos, which is super, super exciting. Cannot wait to see that. I don't know if it was, but, you know, I did my best.
You did an accent.
Yeah.
That was good, very accent.
We've got Melissa McCarthy in Can You Ever Forgive Me, a very sort of dark-tinged film for her. Mm-hmm. We've got Keira Knightley in Colette.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Jackman in The Frontrunner, the new Jason Reitman film.
Mm-hmm.
Life Itself from Dan Fogelman. I mean, the Outlaw King, the new David Mackenzie, which, you know, I'm excited about despite myself. A Private War with Rosamund Pike looking fantastic. And Suspiria.
Suspiria with the Phil Collins theme tune. Everyone's going to love that film.
Also, Wild Rose, which I was on set of last year, is the festival gala starring Jesse Buckley, which should be good as well.
Oh, look at me. I was on set.
I was on set of two of these films. So.
There we go. What else? We have the new Ben Wheatley film.
Yes, which sadly has changed its name from Colin Uanus.
It is now called Happy New Year, Colin Burstead. And if you want to read exclusively about that film, Ben Wheatley talking about it for the first time, pick up the new issue of Empire when it goes on sale next week. And also, we have the new Peter Strickland film, In Fabric. So that's an exciting time for British film. What a great, well done, British film.
Should we give...
Hoorah and huzzah.
So, Doctor Who, right? I know how... Wait, Doctor Who gets his hair cut with...
Okay, two problems Sonic, with what you just said.
Sonic scissors.
Right, first of all, the name of the person is not Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And second of all, it, as it should be perfectly obvious...
It's a woman!
He is not a he right now.
It's Doctor Who, not Doctorette Whoel.
Where does the name come from? Like, why is it called Doctor Who? No, where? Why is it called Doctor Who without a question mark?
Well, I think actually the difference between the two has maybe come a little bit later. But it, I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody
and
in the 60s.
Wasn't the question mark like a symbol of Doctor Who at one point? Like one of them
yeah,
wore
the, yeah. Sylvester McCoy.
So the question mark that was missing from the title found its way onto his clothing.
Let's go with that. Yes,
but you don't know why it's called Doctor Who.
I do not. I wasn't there in the 60s.
So you
I'm very
haven't
old,
Wikipedia'd
but I'm not
it.
That old. No, I haven't.
Fine. Call yourself a Whovian.
I don't think I have, actually. But we should ask James White of this parish. He'd know.
I'm going to say this, and I know he listens to the podcast, and he will probably curse me because it means he's going to have to change his Wi-Fi password. But James White's Wi-Fi password.
No. No.
You're not going to let me give away his Wi-Fi password.
I'm not. I'm going to... Call me picky, call me Mr. Weird, but no, I don't want us to give away people's passwords on the show.
It's to do with Doctor Who.
Yes.
Well, let's leave out there, shall we? Let's have another guest. We're going to have our next two guests in one great big bunch. That's exciting, isn't it? So next week sees the release of a whole bunch of films. One of them is Final Score, which is a thriller in which Dave Bautista tries to stop some bad guys and doing some bad stuff at West Ham's former ground, Upton Park. You know, of course, if you wanted to let people do bad stuff at West Ham's ground, you would just let West Ham play a game of football. Am I right, guys? Am I right? Hello?
We don't know, Chris.
Yes.
Oh,
they're
okay.
Very bad. Anyway, the film's out next week. It's in cinemas and also on Sky Cinema as well. It's a Sky Cinema original film. And I went along to spoke to Dave Bautista tomorrow, so there's every chance it didn't go well and he punched me in the face.
He seems like a nice guy. I don't think he'd do that.
Yeah, but even like a handshake would like break my hand.
That's true.
So let's see how this goes. This is me in excruciating pain talking to the great Dave Bautista. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Dave Bautista. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. You glad to be back in London?
I am. Yeah, I'm always happy to be here. I spent a lot of time here. I'm very, very fond of London.
Yeah, this is like your second home, I'm presuming, over the last
really
few years.
It really is. I've spent more time here in the last 5 years than I probably have at my own home.
Okay, yeah. So we should rename streets after you, is that?
That'd be great.
Leading up to Buckingham
yeah,
Palace.
I'm all excited.
Yeah. Bautista Avenue.
That'd be awesome.
Bautista Street.
Maybe somewhere in the West End. I'm particularly fond of Theatre District, or Kensington is kind of my spot. I love that.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe we can find an off to the side street in Richmond, something like that, near the park.
Okay. Because I was going to ask about how long it took you to feel at home here, and do you have any tourist tips? Say, for example, don't go to a football match on your first day. That's probably...
it's probably a mistake. You know, I'll attend my first match tomorrow, actually. But I did get... What is the mall, the shopping mall next to the Olympic Stadium?
It's Westfield, Stratford.
Stuck in that mall when a game let out. And it was a nightmare. I ended up hiding in this restaurant because I had no idea. By chance, I went there. I thought I was going to be a slow day and I was going to get some food and go shopping. And the game let out and there was just thousands of people that just flooded in. And then I got noticed and then it was like fighting off a mob. And then I just ran in this restaurant and I just kind of hid there in the corner and for hours. I stayed in this restaurant for hours.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was your first experience. Was it your first experience with West Ham?
That was when I was here on bond. First long-term experience was the first Guardians.
Okay.
And I lived in Richmond. But I've been coming here for years with wrestling.
Okay. But you say tomorrow is your your first
yeah,
first football game. Ever. I'm saying football.
First ever football game.
Okay, yeah. And you're saying football too.
Yeah. Is it a game or is it a match?
Well, which one are you going to see? Both. We're happy
with
both.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm going to see the football. I'm going to go see West Ham. Yeah, okay. I'm going to see West Ham play the Wolves.
Okay.
They crushed the Wolves.
At that stadium?
They're going to crush them and beat them by 20 goals.
That's the sort of scoreline that happens in football all the time. Yeah. So clearly you've absorbed it
right.
in your time here.
I know my football.
So you managed to avoid football when you were over here for those years.
Oddly enough, I was going to go watch a game and I got injured. It was when I was on Final Score. We were actually going to go to a West Ham game and okay. I got injured, so I was unable to go. That was actually the same weekend I was going to go see a Triple G fight at the O2 and I missed that because I'm a huge boxing fan. That's my sport, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think he was fighting Kell Brook.
Okay.
Yeah.
This movie, Final Score, it's unrealistic in one way.
It's unrealistic in a lot of ways.
one way specifically.
Yeah, okay.
In that West Ham are getting to a European Cup semifinal.
That's the one way you choose? That's the one way you're going to
be right out of the film.
Yeah. Well, man, we hope... we hope that everybody doesn't analyze it too much. It's, you know, don't be over analytical about this film.
Yeah.
It's a fun film. It's a popcorn film. It was designed to be that.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things. Like, I didn't go and train with Navy SEALs to be technically correct for this film. You know, it was more about the relationship. And it's just not that film. It's not, we're not making Zero Dark Thirty here. We're not making, you know, it's a fun film. It's a popcorn film. It's an action film. And so that's what we want it to be. We want people to go to this film and just kind of have fun watching it. Yeah. Don't take it too seriously.
It does make me want to ride a motorbike up and down. I don't want to give too much away what happens in the film, but you actually did that.
Yeah, we actually did that. I didn't do a lot of the motorcycle. I did a little bit of the motorcycle riding, but all the stunts that you see, and that's the cool thing about this, because we didn't have a large budget for this film. Uh-huh. So a lot of the stuff we do is very practical stuff. A lot of the fight scenes are practical because we didn't have a lot of money for special effects. We used our special effects money for some of the explosions, that stuff like that. And creating, we also had to create the stadium to look like more of a 360 degrees. So you couldn't see where there was ways out, because there are ways out, and people could have like hopped over a fence and gotten out, or, you know, or kicked open a window and gotten out. But we wanted to make it look like it was surrounded and it could be actually locked down. That's kind of where the money went.
That's where the money goes.
Yeah. I think the film was like a $12 million budget, and 11.5 million went to Pierce, and that was for him to show up. We shot all his scenes in 2 hours. No, that's not true at all. I think he took
3 hours.
Three hours. No, I think he was there for a lot of the film. He was there much longer than I thought he was going to be. I was actually honored to work with him, and surprised that he would take a job working with someone like me.
Come on, your reputation precedes you now.
Thank you, I appreciate it. But I was honored to work with him. I really am. I am awestruck by Pierce.
Yeah,
he's a statue of a man. He's a beautiful person, but he's even more beautiful on the inside. Like, he really is, and I say that not joking.
Yeah,
he is such a good-natured, humble man. I love him to death.
You're one of the few people now who can directly compare Brosnan to Craig.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's always an awkward conversation. It is, because I love Pierce and I respect him, but I just love Daniel as Bond. I have to be honest. I love him as Bond. He's my favorite Bond since Sean Connery, and so that's not to dismiss anybody else who has played Bond since then. But just something about Daniel, I think, is special as James Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something. I love him as Bond. I hate to see him slip down. I know eventually he has to, but it bugs me as a fan.
And, of course, you could technically still be knocking around in the Bond universe.
Yeah, we've talked about that. It comes up a lot. And we, you know, believe me, we are lobbying. We talk to Barbara Broccoli all the time, you know, like daily.
She blocking your calls now?
No, yeah, she's blocked.
Oh, Batista again.
God damn it. It's like 3 a.m. Why is he calling me?
Get a burner
hey,
phone.
Hey, Barbara, who are you doing? But it's, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I still have somewhat of a glimmer of hope, but up until now, I have not heard anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, fingers crossed. We never see a corpse.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
See a corpse.
Yeah, I really would like to come back.
You've talked in the past about how, obviously, Guardians was your first movie, and you were plunged into the deep end, and you had doubts about your ability to pull it off.
Yeah, well, it was my first big film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd done smaller films, but nothing to that magnitude. It was a huge deal for me getting this role. Mm.
But since then, you've obviously carved out this niche in Blade Runner 2049 and Bond and films like Bushwick. You're great in Bushwick.
Thanks, man.
So, you know, is that something that, you know, you feel more comfortable now? Especially now you're number one on the call sheet. Movies like this on Bushwick, I guess.
I you know, it's weird. I still have, stage fright somewhat. Uh-huh. You know, I still get insecure and self-conscious, but I'm just so passionate about it. I've never let fear really stop me from doing anything that I loved and I was passionate about. So no, I feel like I watch even now when I watch Bushwick, or even now, we did Final Score 2 years ago, and I watch it and I cringe because I know I've become a better performer since.
Oh, really?
Okay. So it's one of those things where I always feel like I come off every job. I feel like I'm better. I'm on the job learning actor. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm comfortable with it, but I always feel like I can be better, you know, and I want to work with successful, you know, people with very accomplished actors. So no, I'm not completely comfortable. I'm still very self-conscious about my performance.
Do you watch yourself in dailies? Do you do that?
No, I don't. I don't even go watch playbacks because I will see something that I do and I will just harp on it. I can't let it go. I would just think about it, and then it will make me more self-conscious. And then my day will be ruined. Uh-huh. So I just don't even watch playbacks. I usually wait till the finished product, and then, you know, hopefully it's cut together the way I'd like it to be. And it's kind of one of those things: you go and you do your job and perform, and then that's all you can do. You kind of hope, you know, that the director and the editors and the producers, you know, do the best with what you gave them. But at a certain point, unless you're the director or the producer, it's out of your hands. And I was a producer on this film, so I gave my notes. But some of the stuff, it was out of my hands.
Yeah. Did you give your notes to yourself? Or
it's always a collaborative thing. So you always, what we did was after, you know, the first edit, where I said, I really don't like this. And there were certain things about my performance that they chopped up and I wasn't happy about it. And so that's when you kind of have to find a middle ground. And, you know, there's always, like we had one scene that I had with Pierce that when we originally shot it, I thought it was really an incredible scene. It was really heartfelt, but it was just very long. So they just had to trim it down. They had no choice. But I just felt like that was a very important scene. It's also a pacing issue for an action film. You don't want to, you know, an emotional scene that takes 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
So they just, you know, we had to find a middle ground and say that, okay, I'm okay with this.
I guess also you've got that real-time thing going on in the background as well. You got this idea of the match going on at the same time.
Yeah, so you just can't. I mean, that's why, like, certain scenes like that you couldn't stretch them out too long. They just didn't work.
So were you determined, and Scott Mann, the director as well, were you determined to make that real-time thing play out as accurately as possible? So if someone times a movie with a stopwatch.
We tried our best. Again, that's one of those things where hopefully nobody's going to sit down with a stopwatch.
Oh, that's a challenge, Dave.
But we tried, but at the same time, we also realized that it's an entertainment movie, you know, it's not a documentary. So we just wanted to, but we actually, they did try, but that's at some point you have to say, oh, we're just not going to be able to make that happen. So let's just hopefully nobody will notice and they'll just be too wrapped up and wow, this is a great fight scene. they'll just kind of move on.
And of course this was shot largely or how much was actually shot at West Ham's old ground, Upton Park?
Almost completely. We had to come back and do some reshoots. And the funny thing is when we came back to do the reshoots, the stadium wasn't there anymore.
Wow. It's flats now, I think, or it's being...
Are they built already?
It's 2 years now,
so they would be, yeah. But yeah, I guess that's what it's kind of... It's just a bittersweet thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But this is how this came about, is because our producer, Mark Goldberg, came up with this idea, and he knew that they were going to destroy the stadium. And he grew up in the stadium, and it was really special to him, and he wanted to kind of pay tribute to it. Mm-hmm. And this was, this is how he did it.
Those toilets, there's a fight scene in the toilets.
Yeah.
And they look like football stadium toilets.
Yeah, and they were.
I imagine they smelled like football stadium toilets. Were they okay?
They did not smell great. They didn't, you know. And by that time, you know, the stadium was being prepped to be demolished.
Yeah.
So people were still using the toilets, but they weren't actually functional. Mm-hmm. You know, they were, so they smelled particularly bad.
Unhappy memories.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It was rare. Yeah. I know it sounds odd, but it's really a great luxury to go and not be confined to a stage and not being confined to a trailer, but we actually to go and work in this big, broad space. And we had our the suites were what we used as dressing rooms. Mm-hmm. So they were enormous and they were like comfortable. And we go in every day and we go in there and we have our suites and our bathrooms, not like a little trailer bathroom, like full on bathrooms. And then you slide open these big doors and it's just step into this big stadium that's like got people like sprinkled out here and there.
Yeah.
But you could hear them you could hear the echoes of voices like around the stadium.
Yeah.
But it was like being in church. It was very peaceful. Like, no, it was like very peaceful. And there was a very serene, calming feeling to be in that environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, like, great memories. That's where Pierce and I, like, he'd always come by and we'd literally just sit in the stands and just have great conversations, man.
He'd go, "I hear you prefer Daniel Craig," and then it'd be awkward.
Well, and that's why it's uncomfortable, yeah, because I don't want to make it seem like, because Daniel and I mean, we had some fun conversations, but we never had any deep, like, heartfelt conversations.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, but I did have those conversations with Pierce, you know, like life lessons.
Yeah.
I felt like I was...
He's been through a lot in his life.
Yeah, he's been through a lot, man, and I could feel, and he was not afraid to share it. And, like, I felt like every conversation we had was very spiritual, and I was learning something from my grandmaster. I mean, that's what it felt like. And then Daniel was usually joking about something, or he was talking about, you know, he was singing a song, or we were talking about fighting, or he was talking about rugby. Mm-hmm. You know, it was things like that. But, you know, Pierce was talking about life and losing people and loving people. You know, then that was a difference. Yeah.
What a contrast.
Yeah.
You got to work with Timothy Dalton next. You got to collect all the bombs.
He's not going to speak to me at all.
He will shun you. Yeah. He will shun you. When tomorrow, after you've had your first experience of football, gets into your bloodstream,
mm-hmm.
your next step is to go to Anfield and watch a Liverpool game with Daniel Craig, who's a big fan.
Okay. You know, I'm asked every once in a while to pick teams.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, when Liverpool is playing, I always pick Liverpool. Because I don't know
Keep
why. Just
like
Liverpool, it just seems like a tough town. And it's like a town that you don't want to pick against.
Uh-huh.
It seemed like it would be like a team full of tough, rugged, you know, blue-collar, hard-nosed workers.
That's it, yeah.
And I just don't want to pick against that team. But are they those guys? They're probably... Like, how many of the players would actually be from Liverpool?
At the moment, one.
One?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's probably a tough SOB, right?
He's a young kid just off the streets.
He just goes out and gets in fights after the game.
He's called Trent Alexander-Arnold, and he's going to be one of the best players in the world.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll look out for you heard it here first.
Yeah, cool.
Brilliant. Dave Bautista, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah,
thanks so much, Dave. Thanks, man.
Pleasure.
And that was Dave Bautista. And then also out next week, we have American Animals, which is a true life tale from British director Bart Layton. It's an American set film, but it's directed by Bart Layton and stars the Irish actor Barry Keoghan. You would know him from Dunkirk, where he plays George. George, he's falling down the stairs, George. Don't fall down the stairs, George. And the...
not a quote from Dunkirk.
Not George,
don't do that,
George. No, George. Oh, he's dead.
He was also in The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
He was in The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which, of course, was the last film from...
Yorgos Lanthimos.
It was better than the last time.
It
was better the last time. But he is, and he's going to be in...
Why the Last Man.
Correct, as well. So, they came at the Paul Booth a couple of weeks ago. Nick Desemlian is leading this interview, but I was there producing and / recording it, so I leap in from time to time. Sorry about that. And you will hear us probe Barry Keoghan for hot scoops about Why the Last Man and get absolutely nowhere. So here you go. Enjoy. Bart and Barry and Bacon Buddies. Enjoy.
We're very excited to welcome director Bart Layton and star Barry Keoghan of American Animals. How are you guys?
Thanks for having us. That's
good, yeah. Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah. This is a really interesting film. This is a heist movie, but I had never seen a heist movie where they're trying to steal books. Has that been done before, as far as you know?
Do you know what? I don't think it has, yeah. It's. I think it's not just that it's a weird target for a heist. It's also... that the perpetrators are also probably not your usual suspects as well.
Mm.
And I think that was part of what made it sort of bizarre and interesting for us.
Yeah, sort of having a library as the target sort of gives you a Rafifi thing because they have to be quiet. It's a library.
Yeah, so, tiptoe in, tiptoe out.
Yeah, and so it's another interesting thing about this film is that the characters, who are obviously based on real guys, they study films. Is that a real thing that those guys actually did?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing about, you know, I think audiences find it hard to believe that that we didn't take, or I didn't take, massive sort of artistic license with the story. You know, pretty much everything you see is something that really happened. And yeah, and you know, I guess if you're not, you know, a criminal or criminally minded and you've never done anything like that before, you know, as one of the characters, you know, the real character said, there aren't books on how to commit a robbery. So they go to Blockbuster and they literally hired every heist movie they could find. And, you know, we always say, you know, if they'd bothered to watch them to the end, they probably would have realised that most of them don't end terribly well.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that we kind of said on set was, you know, in their minds it was Ocean's 11, and in reality it was sort of Dog Day Afternoon.
So they watch Reservoir Dogs, they watch Ocean's 11, they watch Rafifi is one of the films that they watch?
Yeah, I mean, I think they just literally tried to watch everything. I mean, you know, there are places where, you know, I will make reference or kind of pay homage to a movie that, like The Killing or Asphalt Jungle or something like that, that are probably I love as a heist movie, which was probably less of an influence, you know. They were watching, you know, obviously Ocean's 11 and Snatch and things like that. You know, that was the era. And, you know, I think the thing about it is that as much as, you know, the target of the robbery was these books worth millions of dollars that were held in the Special Collections Museum of the University Library, it was more about the fantasy of, like, kind of almost living in a movie. You know, one of the real guys in one of the letters from prison described it as, he said it was like our version of Fight Club. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like this secret that we had. We were planning this kind of extraordinary thing. And the truth is, I'm not sure they ever, or of the four of them, I'm not sure how many of them ever thought they would end up going through with it, that they thought they were going to, you know, that they were lost in this fantasy, and the more time they spent planning, the more of a reality it became, but also the more detached they became from reality. You know, they didn't realise, I think they thought it was going to be a victimless crime, that it was going to be like this well-oiled machine, and as we see, it's not. Yeah. It's not quite like Ocean's 11.
It's not. You do really interesting thing. Your first film, The Imposter, was a documentary, but with sort of little recreations within it. And then this is kind of the flip side of that, where it's mostly fiction, but you bring in the real guys and you kind of blur the lines, which I thought was really interesting. Sometimes the real guy and the guy playing him is in the same shot. Barry, how was
Bart Layton twist, I call it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you have a name for that type of thing? I've come up with Thriller-umentary, which you can have if you want.
Thriller-umentary.
Like, it's a documentary.
The Imposter's it may have been you guys who came up with it. It was a docu-noir, which I thought was... That's cool.
Better than Thriller-umentary.
Thriller-umentary. You know, that could catch on.
There's time to get it on the Blu-ray, I'm just saying.
It takes longer to say it than it does to watch the film.
Well, yeah, and you play Spencer, yeah. Barry. How was it meeting him?
Well, I didn't, you know, the scene that I'm in with Spencer is the only time, the only time I met him during film. I mean, because Bart wanted to keep me and the cast away from meeting the real lads. I mean, down to, you know, because it's, as an actor, you want to imitate and you want to pick up the traits and, you know, and given as well that they've had a good few years now to reflect on what they did, and, you know, they might have an influence to say to me, look, don't play me as, you know, I wasn't like that, you know, and they have a kind of, they want me to be nice then, you know. So, yeah, I got to meet him then afterwards at the premieres, all the lads, and we hung out then. We hung out a lot then, yeah.
Yeah, I just felt like, you know, obviously as an actor, if you're going to play a real person, you're going to think, well, why can't I go and hang out with them? And, you know, but, you know, if I wanted to portray you when you were in your teens or in your 20s, you know, like there's a limit to how useful spending time with you now is. And also, you know, most of that, you know, they're 10 years older. Most of the 10 years they've been in prison and had a lot of time to kind of think about it and post-rationalize it. And in a way, like Barry says, you want, you know, you want to kind of allow your actors to find their versions of those characters and relate to them and pour themselves into it and not be limited. And as you said, you know, there's certain of them, there's a lot in the movie that those guys are really ashamed of. And you could imagine that if they had access to the actors who were playing them, they might say, you know, don't make me out to be too much of a
right.
ass.
Yeah. They might try and sway your performance a little bit.
Yeah.
I walked more cool than that. is it? I read that you contacted them when they were still in prison.
Mm.
How was their reaction? Were they excited to hear from you, or were they?
Well, it was funny because I think probably, you know, it ended up being, I mean, you know, without wanting to give too much away, you know, they, you know, they're certainly not the victims of the, you know, there was a victim. There was a, you know, a librarian who they effectively took hostage in a way, but it was something, you know, they let a bad idea go way too far, and then it, when it unraveled, you know, it was devastating for their families, for the community, you know, all of this stuff. So I by the time I spoke to them or wrote to them, and I worked with a co-producer called Poppy Dixon, who I worked with on The Imposter, and she initially got in touch with them and went down and saw them, and I think they hadn't really had a you know, they hadn't had counselling, they hadn't really been able to talk to anyone about it, so suddenly all, like, the floodgates open and all of this stuff came out about, because we only really wanted to understand the why of it. It was like, why would you, with all of this privilege and opportunity and good educations and good families, why would you squander all of that on something, even though the books are worth tens of millions of dollars? What, you know, to go through that, the chances of getting away with it, then being able to fence the books, then being able to take them to Amsterdam, you know, and they're massive, these books. Mm. They're proper.
Yeah, they're heavy as well.
Yeah.
Need a Kindle edition.
Yeah. And they're works of art, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that they thought that they would actually get away, that was all we wanted to know. And then, you know, a lot of stuff came out about, you know, them wanting to, you know, Barry can talk but about his character's motivation, but, you know, he was an artist who was desperate to have a story to tell and to have something worthy of making art about. And if your life is too nice, and you're reading about all the great artists that have ever existed, and the one thing they all have in common is that they've seen some pretty...
The bacon sandwiches have arrived.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Barry, you just going to crack into that?
Come bearing gifts.
Live bacon sandwich eating. So, Barry, unfortunately, my next question is kind of for you, so to give you some warning. So one of the sequences I loved is the scene where the guys dress up as old men. They disguise themselves as kind of old codgers.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, have you seen...
Barry did not stop complaining about
it. I was a moan. I'd tell you. I was like, it's too sticky, though. I don't want to do it. It's too warm, though, you know.
Was it not fun to dress up as...
I mean...
Once you were in it, you loved it, but the whole process...
But I was like an old little man. I was like, oh, you know, and I kind of added to it, you know. You see me slumping, like, you know. Like,
are you trying to say you were, like, in character?
I was in character. I was, like, in the zone. I was, like, yeah.
Did you start eating toffees and sort of doing Werther's Originals?
And then they gave me a fat pack as well, which, you know, to add to it, it was like, oh, really? You know, and then the mic, you know, and... But yeah, no.
So it wasn't a fun thing.
No, but I looked great, you know, and I really, I ended up looking like Einstein, didn't I? Though.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of kind of like makeup and like prosthetic stuff, which I guess isn't. All
but Evan
that
was
fun.
Great at putting it on himself. Like, yeah, he was the master at that, you know.
I was wondering. I'm a Beastie Boys fan, and one of their music videos, directed by Spike Jonze. Ricky's Theme, where the four Beastie Boys dress up as old guys,
really?
And sort of wander around. I think they play basketball as well. It just really reminded me of that because they got the big beards and everything. Was that something you were aware of?
There was definitely, you know, there was talk of it being a bit Beastie Boys, because the thing about it was that you don't want it to be, you know, there is something comedic about it, you know, that the idea that they have in order to kind of go unnoticed or to get, you know, to go into this library. I think they felt that the least threatening thing was going to be to dress up as old men. And there's this line in the film where Barry's character says, you know, being old is the closest thing to being invisible.
Mm-hmm.
There is something truthful about that. You know, there is something about this idea that we kind of ignore old, but, you know, when they're in these public spaces or whatever, that somehow, you know, we don't pay them a whole lot of attention, and they're certainly not threatening. So they'd come up with that idea that...
it's so clever, that, though, isn't
you know,
it?
That they were going to... They were going to, but of course, you know, 20-year-olds trying to do their own makeup and prosthetics and put wrinkles on and moustaches and wigs and beard. I mean, you know, how you know, it's the chance that it's going to draw more attention than it's going to allow them to kind of pass it. And so there was a comedic thing intentionally, but also you don't want to cross the line too much into...
You've got to keep it tense.
Absolutely have to keep it tense because they are there...
I wonder if the lads are, you know, before they do it, like, we should get a picture of this, you know what I mean?
They must have been tempted. I mean,
there's a picture somewhere.
I mean, you joke, but when I was deep into, you know, researching it, I got access to the FBI files, you know, the kind of freedom of information thing, and it takes a while. And in the files, I mean, you joke about them taking a photo of themselves in disguise. There was an A4 page where... all of the plan is set out in writing, and they've left it. And it even says, because they gave themselves code names, each of them gave themselves a colour based on, you know, obviously, well, Reservoir Dogs, but actually taking a Pelham 123, you know, Mr. Green, Mr. Brett, you know, and there was an even Mr. Pink. And on this piece of paper, which is in the FBI files, it says... Mr. Green, Spencer Ryan, Spencer, Mr. Yellow. Like, he'd literally written it down, which would imply that they were... I'm not allowed to swear.
You can swear.
Yeah, which would imply that they're fucking idiots. But actually, I think the thing that you see when you see the movie is, like, that they were sort of lost in trying to live in a movie.
Yeah.
And they allowed that to go... so far that they ended up crossing a line that they should never have crossed and probably, possibly never intended to cross sort of thing. But yeah, I actually, the costumes they wear was slightly based on taking a Pelham 123, more than the Beastie Boys.
Okay, all right, yeah. There we go. Are you somebody that's just fascinated in crime? Because obviously the two films you've done, or do you feel like that gives, the two films you've done so far kind of give a false sense
of... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I guess... It's the first thing is, you know, is it a cracking yarn? Are you going to sit in that theatre and are you going to be beset by the what happens next of it? Or, you know, are you going to feel gripped by it? But that's one part of it. The next part has to be, is it actually a story worth telling? Is it about anything of value? You know, is there a conversation that you're going to come out of the theatre, you're going to go to the pub and... And with this, you know, with The Imposter, that was as much a film about self-deception as it was about deception. This is a movie, really, which is about a group of very lost young men who are desperately searching for an identity. And, you know, and we're in a culture where being average... You know, the strapline on the poster is nobody wants to be ordinary. And, you know, the reality is we're in a culture where being average is really... not acceptable anymore, because the access to being famous putting all your stuff out there on Twitter or whatever it is, or, you know, and that you start to, you know, I worry, like, I've got really young kids and I worry about them feeling like their status and their place in the world is going to be tied to how...
Depends on the followers.
Yeah, right? And that... And so what it was about was these young men who were trying to leave a mark on the world for the wrong reasons, sort of thing, you know. So I guess I'm less interested in crime, more interested in, you know, these quite morally confused characters who we can all kind of relate to, even though we probably shouldn't. And you vicariously have this kind of roller coaster emotional journey with them.
Yeah, and Barry, is that something you can identify with as well? That idea that nobody wants to be ordinary, or
you know, that push towards social media.
Yeah, I've definitely stole books from my library in Ireland. I really mean
you know,
that.
Just
I've not brought them back.
Well, you confessed to a crime, man.
Sorry about that, lads.
Which one for you?
They actually barred me from the library as well because I used to go in and just, like, you know, try. There used to be a section of, you know, it's the quiet, and then this was the older section. And just as a kid, I always wanted to go to the older section, you know. So I used to run in there and hide in between the the books, the shelves, and that. But yeah, nobody wants to be ordinary. Yeah, it's definitely for me being on Instagram and even Twitter, like, you know, it's, I was only chatting to Sean about that as well, my girlfriend. You know, it's so, you know, we were chatting to someone and they were like, we said their name and they were like, how many followers do they have? You know, that was the first question, not like, what are they like to sit with or what are they like to hang out with? It was more, how many followers do they have on Instagram? You know, and they, if you were to give a low number, they'd be like, oh, you know, and they're less interested automatically than... It's really, really taken over that, you know, that status thing.
Is that especially with being an actor? Because I've read that, you know, stars are more likely to get... You lose role if you're not on social media.
Do you know, I have a mate who went off Twitter because he was losing out to another lad, like, you know, because he had more, like, you know, the people are looking at that, like, what's his fan base and... It's definitely come down to that now, you know.
But Barry, I'm guessing you run your own Instagram account, given that your bio simply says "fuck you."
Oh yeah, there you are. Do you know what I mean?
did you think long and hard about that one, or were there a number of other options?
No, but that's me, you know, and I wouldn't ever let anyone control because, I mean, as well, I think Twitter and Instagram is a great.
They might say something polite, which would really offend Barry.
Do you know, it's a great platform for, you know, to push yourself for things well, do you know, and have your say on things. So, but again, I don't take them things. I wouldn't get into big spiels about, you know, like having big statements to say on Twitter and on Instagram. I just use it for the crack.
Damn straight.
I just wanted to ask about Why the Last Man. That's obviously a huge bit of news that just dropped, I think, this week, that you're going to be Yorick, which is obviously the sort of very famous comic book where you're the last guy on Earth and there are only women left and you have a monkey.
Yeah.
Have you had any tips given to you about working with a monkey?
I've not, no. I've actually not even got into that yet. Okay. But, no, I'm excited for that. Like, you know, it's some... I mean, being the last man on Earth, it's crazy. Bad. Imagine, I mean, mankind relying on me. You'd be all doomed.
It's just a single episode.
I feel like after spending 3 months on set with you, I'm more qualified to answer, like, how do you work with a monkey?
No, I'm excited to dig into that, yeah.
Did you know the story before? Have you...
No, I've not read the comics, you know. I have all the comics at home now, and that's the first thing I'm doing when I get back.
It's good.
Like, digging into them.
It's good.
You know, that's homework. Like, imagine your homework being, these graphic novels to dig into.
No, it's exciting. That one's been around for a very long time.
Has it, yeah?
Yeah, I remember writing a news story, like, 10 years ago about...
Oh, it's been around that long, has it?
Oh, yeah. Jeez. I think Shia LaBeouf was going to do it at one point, and long time ago. But no, it's exciting. I think
I beat you to it, Shia. Jared, be happy with that.
Shia sitting at home going, curse you, Barry. Barry Keegan? Curse you, Barry.
He bought his own monkey in preparation and everything. So he's going to be. No, he didn't.
I was like, Jesus. Have a lot of them up there.
Does Why the Last Man feel like, you know, there's a, certainly last year for you seems to have been a breakthrough, what with killing the sacred deer.
I've not worked in a year though, you know.
So for everyone else it feels like a breakthrough, whereas you're just like, what the fuck am I doing next?
I've sat back in Kerry going, what will I do? Like, you know, and a lot of that has been down to being picky, you know, and I've been blessed in a way that I've got to work with Bart and Yorgos and Chris Nolan and these amazing filmmakers like that. You know, now I'm trying to live up to, you know, certain, you know, there's a reputation of to have, and so I'm being very picky and and what I do and what projects, you know, what stories I want to tell. So,
well, guys, thank you very much. And Barry, there's still time to return those library books.
Oh, yeah.
if the library's still open.
I'm going back to take more.
No, Barry, we talked about this. You don't write down your plan and you don't tell your plan out loud on a podcast. That way the cops can trace it back. And we'll be accessories after the fact, so we're all screwed. So thanks a lot, Barry Keoghan.
I'll join in.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, no,
thank you.
Okay, so Final Score and American Animals will be reviewed on next week's show, the live show. Once again, if you haven't got tickets to that, you do fancy coming along, check it out, kingsplace.co.uk. So we talk about this. What's out this week, though? Let's talk about the films that are out this week and tell people what to see at the multiplex.
Yes.
Let's.
And first up is Upgrade. That Lee Whannell special is available now for you to listen to. And this is the second film as director of Lee Whannell, who wrote the first few Saw movies and has worked with James Wan for ages. But he's striking out on his own now. And this is a Blumhouse production, a fairly low-budget sci-fi with some pretty big ideas. Hell's Bells.
So, yes, Logan Marshall Green, not Tom Hardy, stars as Gray, who is living in its fairly near future. We're talking probably, what, 30, 40 years probably?
About that, yeah.
And he is a determinedly sort of old-fashioned guy. He doesn't like a lot of the kind of high-tech around him. He works on actual petrol cars like a weirdo instead of self-driving electric things like everybody else. And then tragedy strikes one night. He's just been delivering this new fancy car to one of his billionaire clients, and he and his wife are attacked on the way home. So she is killed and he is left paralyzed.
Fridged, more like.
Well, indeed. And then the same billionaire client who he'd just been delivering to feels bad about this, obviously, and suggests that Gray become essentially his experimental guinea pig for a new treatment, which could once again enable him to walk. The only problem with this is that it turns out to have some, let's say, unexpected side effects.
He turns him into RoboCop.
It turns him into RoboCop in a way. Yes. Yeah. This is a very weird film in a lot of ways. And I mean that as a compliment, I think, because in the same scene can go from being extremely funny to being super violent. Mm-hmm. I mean, like RoboCop at least levels of violence.
Oh, this is definitely R-rated.
Seriously, yeah, absolutely. and it's unexpected in that way. And I think it kept us both guessing, because Chris and I, we turned to each other in the screening room at one point and we predicted a thing that was going to happen. And we were both entirely right and entirely wrong.
Mm, I think I know exactly what you're talking about. And yeah, I was too.
Right?
Both entirely right and entirely wrong.
And I think it's really clever that that the film can keep you guessing in that way while sort of, you know, for the most part... sticking to a kind of genre structure. I think it's good
feels
stuff.
Like an extended, expensive Black Mirror episode in many ways.
Yeah, that's fair.
I really liked it. I thought the action was fantastic, the choreography in particular, that his fighting style is incredibly mechanical and robotic. So it's not sort of wushu, you know, the stuff we're used to seeing. It's choreographed in a very different way, and it stands out because of that. And I also love the camera work during the fights, where he does this thing where he just sort of stands bolt upright, defying physics and gravity and stuff, and the camera sort of bolted to his orientation, so it follows him around. It's very, very effective. And I like the future aesthetic, which is the future apparently is going to be weirdly triangular, which is, you know, nice. But no, it's good. Loads of fun. It's not the most, shall we say... you can kind of tell where it's going for a large part of it until you can't. And I thought, you know, from a story point of view, it's not the most convoluted. It's not the most sophisticated. I mean, it's kind of it's a sci-fi revenge horror, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a kind of by the numbers one. But it's loads of fun. I thought it was great. And Logan Marshall Green, who is bootleg Tom Hardy, and I can say that because he en masse followed all of you on Twitter this week and not me. So fuck him.
Hey.
Sorry, didn't mean that. He's great. Love him. He's very good in this.
He's very good in
this. Still
doesn't
follow me, but he's very good in this.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd be falling over himself to follow you now. Now you've said fuck him in a way I can't cut out. Honestly. This guy. What are you going to be like next week?
Unleashed.
Live podcast. I'm going to have to turn your mic off.
It might be wise.
Oh, God.
It might be wise. I shall try and avoid caffeine on the day.
All week, I think, would be
and
good.
And sugar.
I might have to blindfold you as well so you don't get the stimulus of a live audience.
Put me in like a gimp suit.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the film. I really liked this film. I thought it was... what did you say? What, a gimp suit?
Just, you know, suggesting.
If you're coming to the live podcast and you want to bring a gimp suit for James to wear, then do so. I liked Upgrade a lot. I thought it's a bit of a shame that this film kind of stiffed. Let's be honest about it. It stiffed in the States. Mm. And it's a Blumhouse film, so I guess box office expectations aren't the same for those movies, $5 million budgets, as they are for the big ones. But, you know, they've just had Get Out, they've just had Split, and so they might have been hoping that this one breaks out the same way those films did. And I thought it was really well anchored by Pound Shop Tom Hardy. That's
unfollowed.
Unfollowed immediately. The real LMG is what he is on Twitter. And he seems like quite a cool dude. Because this is Venom. This movie is Venom, right?
Yeah, this is the best Venom movie I think we're going to see this year.
It could well be. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows?
Or not. We don't know yet.
It is about a man who looks a lot like Tom Hardy, who is...
Given powers. Which may have a dark side.
And he has to share his body with something. So, yeah, it's interesting.
It is in many ways an upgrade on Venom.
We don't know that.
Venom could be a five-star film. You don't know. It could be.
It is in an infinite universe, all things are possible.
It's not necessarily going to be a turd blowing in the wind.
No. In fact, in an infinite universe somewhere, there has to be a great Venom film.
Yes.
Yes.
Who knows? It could be this one. Three stars then for Venom. sorry. Genuine mistake. Three stars then for Upgrade. Did they get it?
No.
Three stars. I got it right. That's right.
Oh, okay.
The film's called Upgrade.
Yeah, it is.
Three stars then for Upgrade, which is, we always say in the podcast, is a recommendation. And next up is very much a recommendation.
Yeah.
It's a big old whopping five-star belter.
Oh,
the latest from Pavel Pavlikovsky.
This is Cold War. It is set in Poland shortly after World War II. Begins in 1949, I think. Viktor is sent around the country to basically make communist propaganda and meets a sort of local peasant girl type who's Zula, and they begin a sort of a romance, and it's the story of their romance over the years that follow, against they're both sort of weirdly anti-authoritarian in their own ways, but obviously in a totalitarian regime it's quite hard to get away with that. They have to maybe go to the West if they want to sort of express themselves fully, but that's not to say that the West is a paradise either. So it's a kind of an up and down story in terms of its construction. It's got fantastic, fantastic performances, obviously from both leads whose names, I apologise, I'm probably going to horribly mispronounce, but it's Thomas Kott and Joanna Kulig.
Yes, he is rumoured to be one of the reasons behind Danny Boyle's departure from Bond 25.
Interesting.
One of the stories, and these are just rumours, just allegations we have to say, is that Danny Boyle wanted to cast him as the bad guy, and he met resistance, shall we say.
Well, they would be foolish to resist on this evidence, but, you know, this is not a long film. It's kind of an epic romance in under 90 minutes, which is pretty impressive.
Every film should be under 90 minutes.
Many films should be under 90 minutes, but it is also just a gorgeous, gorgeous film. Like, Pawlikowski has an eye for an image like few directors out there. And Andrew said in his review, Andrew Lowry said in his review for us, that certain shots of this should be in a gallery, in a museum. And I completely agree. This is one of those things, I would just have it playing on the wall of my house just for the gorgeousness of it, if I could. I love it. So yeah, a beautiful, beautiful film. Very simple kind of story, very short running time. This is not one of those art house films that's going to bore your bum off. It's beautiful, and it's funny as well. It's not just, you know, sort of romantic melodrama the whole way through. It's a gorgeous film. We give it five stars.
Five stars. Five stars in for Pavel Pavlikovsky's Cold War. I have not seen it yet myself, sadly, but I will be checking it out hopefully this weekend. Looking forward to it a great deal. And because I'm useless, I also haven't seen Idris Elba's directorial debut, Yardie, which is about a young Jamaican gangster who comes to London, pisses off the local kingpin, and then strikes out on his own. Our review gives it three stars and says it is neither a luridly enjoyable piece of Scarface-style pulp or a nuanced genre subversion, but it is a fitfully entertaining 1980s gangster thriller with a really interesting sense, apparently, of time and place. You really get the sense of Idris Elba reveling in the London of the 1980s, a period of which, of course, he would have been, what, in his teens?
If even, yeah.
Yeah, running around.
Maybe he was
believing in better. Well, 3 stars then for Yardie. 3 stars for Fenim. Everything's getting 3 stars this week, apart from the one that gets 5. 3 stars then for Yardie, so do check that out if you fancy it. And we gave 2 stars as well to The Happy Time Murders. Sounds like it doesn't quite live up to its premise, which is, of course, Melissa McCarthy is a cop who teams up with a puppet cop in a world where puppets are running around and doing their puppety things. Look, if you want to see a movie, a bad taste movie about puppets, seek out Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles. I prepare yourself, be warned, but also thank me as well afterwards.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Or they'll thank me, Helen.
Oh, stop it.
They'll thank me, all right. Don't worry about that.
I can't have you doing that when I'm wearing earphones. It's too upsetting.
I can't help it.
No!
A character in Meet the Feebles talks like that, and so I have to talk like this myself, Helen. Why are you putting your fingers in your ears, Helen?
It's the way he says the word Helen that's most upsetting.
Come back to me, Helen.
Oh, God. It's still going.
And we get 4 stars as well to another movie out this week, which is Searching, which stars John Cho as a fraught father searching desperately for his missing daughter. And this is a very interesting film because it's pretty much self-contained. It takes place on his computer screen as he tries to hunt down clues that will lead to her whereabouts. So 4 stars for Searching, and check that out if you can. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We will be up a day later with that podcast. We'll be up on Saturday. We're recording it live, as you've heard, at the London Podcast Festival on Friday night. Do come along to that if you're in the area and you fancy it, and you fancy seeing me desperately try and restrain James from giving out passwords and telling Hollywood A-listers to go fuck themselves. It's going to be fun.
I make no promises.
Bring the gimp suit. We may need to restrain him.
And I'll be bringing a shark.
Yes.
Which I may or may not jump at some point.
You bring a gimp suit, he brings a shark. Latch the Empire Podcast way, and that's how you get James Dyer.
I'm not sure I can come anymore. I feel like I might be busy.
No, Helen, I've just checked all your friends and your family, and you're totally free.
My hair really needs washing.
Doctor Who! No, until that auspicious occasion, of course, it is goodbye from James Dyer. There he is. Look at him. Resplendent.
Bye?
It's goodbye from Helen.
That was such a resplendent farewell. Toodaloo, everybody.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to search desperately for a punchline to the question of where does Doctor Who? Hey, you know where Doctor Who goes to get his haircut? By next week, by the live show, I promise thee, by Grabthar's hammer, which is a famous Doctor Who quote, I shall have an answer to this.
I'd like to apologise to all the sci-fi fans.
Anyway, enough of that. As Doctor Who himself once said, live long and prosper.
Oh,
thanks for listening. Goodbye.